This podcast is part of the Zedia Network. That's media with a Z. For more information on the Zedia Network, you can check them out on Twitter, at Zedia Network. Now to the show. And welcome to the Browns Huddle Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Hand. We are now part of the Zedia Network, which is media spelled with a Z. You can find Zedia Network on Twitter, at Zedia Network, or online, zedianetwork.com. Our first guest is Daniel Kelly, a former scout of the New York Jets and author of Whatever It Takes. We are excited to have him on the show. Daniel, welcome to the Browns Huddle Podcast.
Hey, thank you, Jason, so much. It's great to be on the show. I've enjoyed our chat offline. I'm looking forward to putting the ball on the tee and getting going on the show with you tonight.
Absolutely. Attitude for me, I'm a big believer in having a positive attitude. And I've actually followed you on Twitter for a little while. We've been in communication for about a week or so, and I've actually heard you on a previous podcast. And really what jumped off the page to me is that you have a fantastic attitude, and you just have a way about you that, really inspires me, to just say the least. But it's very simple. Whatever we do in life, it starts with having the right attitude. That's why I wanted to start this interview talking about just being a positive person. And you seem very motivated, and it's obvious that you have an extreme attitude for life. When did you first learn that positive thinking will get you where you want to be?
I think when I was growing up, I think just having the influence of Joe Gibbs, my favorite team growing up was the Redskins, having the influence of Joe Gibbs and Bobby Beathard. Joe Gibbs was extremely positive, and Bobby Beathard brought in a lot of positive players. So to me, it's like just kind of growing up, and it's kind of like being a plant in some soil. You know, when you're around that type of an environment or study that kind of environment as intensely as I did, I think it just kind of became part of who I am, growing up as a teenager in Minnesota.
We all have challenges in life, and that's part of why positive thinking is so crucial and having a good attitude so crucial, because it doesn't always go your way. No. We do have challenges. What's your process for overcoming challenges?
Well, for me personally, it's trusting God. That's the big part for me is just, because there is so much in life that life hasn't gone the way I expect it to go. Let's put it that way. And so learning how to manage my expectations and having that relationship with Jesus Christ for me has been critically important, because I can trust, because when I look back at my life, Jason, to our listeners, to me, it's like playing connect the dots. It's like, the old game we play as kids, with the connecting with the pencil, the dots. And to me, it makes perfect sense looking back. But when I'm in the present moment or I'm looking forward, it's really foggy at times, kind of like the fog bowl back with the Chicago Bears and Philadelphia Eagles back in the day when you couldn't see your head in front of your face. at Soldier Field. So to me, having that trust, because there's so many times in life I've lost so much in my life personally, and I've been through, and things haven't turned out the way I wanted them to so many times, that if I didn't have that trust in God to if I was just like trying to rely on wanting my way and wanting what I wanted to have done, I'd be in an insane asylum by now. Because it hasn't turned out that way for me personally in a lot of cases. But I will say this, it's turned out better than I could ever imagine. So at the same time, it's just not, because like one of my chapters in my book is titled Play Action. And to me, that's the way I've seen God operate in my life. The play action when the quarterback takes a snap, does the fake handoff. And I'm that safety. I'm that proverbial safety that thinks it's run, right? And so I go right up to the line of scrimmage. I'm like, I'm going to make this tackle, and all of a sudden I look up and the ball is sailing over my head, and something completely different happens in my life than I was ever expecting or imagining, but something altogether much more incredible than I could ever have imagined. So that's to me the key for me to the game. It's just my trust in God as far as being able to manage when things don't turn out the way I want them to.
That's great words, Daniel. Eye on the prize. Sometimes it's easy to forget what the goal is, what the prize that you're going for is. How do you and we're going to get into your story in a minute, but how do you keep your eye on the prize to where, you know, when challenges come about and they block you from potentially getting to where you want to go, how do you keep your eye on that goal to keep moving forward?
It's something that's shown to me, really, Jason. You know, Mark Pressman is one of my personal friends of the last 25 years. He's the coach. He's the only coach in football history that's won two different league MVPs with two different leagues. Rich Gannon with the Oakland Raiders, and of course up in Canada with the Montreal Alouettes with Anthony Covello. And what Mark's kind of, you know, taught me throughout the years, and he's a very positive guy, and a guy that, you know, he says if you can see it, you can achieve it. And really, Jason, it's been something for me. It's something that comes from the deepest core parts of who I am in my soul. It's I have this vision. The opening quote of my book, my favorite quote of all time, is by Jason Swift, who actually back in way back in the day, 1667 to 1745, way back in the day, he writes, "Vision is the art of seeing what's invisible to others," is a quote. And that's been my favorite quote in life. Absolutely. So to me, I have this, I can see things that are not in the natural. Things are shown to me, things that, and there's this deep burning. It's the only thing I can compare it to, Jason, is almost like the eternal flame that burns at JFK, you know, at his graveside. It's like this fire, this burning, passionate, just fire that burns inside me, that no matter what the circumstances are, I can kind of see things out there just beyond, you know, the realm that we're in. And I have this burning passion inside me that just keeps me going. Because as I sit here today, I can share with you that I know for a fact, I don't think or hope or you know, I know for a fact that my time is going to come to be a GM in the NFL. And when it does, I'm going to build the greatest dynasty in the history of the National Football League. And that includes what New England's done. And so I can see that goal. So I keep moving towards it. And the little things will happen along the way that will confirm that goal and show me that, you know, okay, that I'm on the right track, if that makes sense.
Makes perfect sense to me. You talked about vision. You know, you could take the Empire State Building in New York City. That didn't come about until somebody thought about it first.
Right? Exactly.
We see the Empire State Building. We know it's there. But that started with a thought.
Absolutely.
Know, so, and then it was built. That's the same thing with you. You know, you want to become a GM in the NFL. It starts with a thought, the mm-hmm. goal of doing that. And then everything else is just going to eventually get out of your way because you're going to go like a bull in a china shop. You know?
Yeah, I've been accused of being that before. So, yeah, absolutely.
Very good. You know, I also think of confidence. Confidence is key to doing great things. Where do you get your confidence from?
From God. I mean, it's the only way to explain it. I mean, I keep going back to it, but I have just this, because I've had just about everything that can possibly knock a person down, try to knock me down in my life, you know, and just to kind of give some clarity to what I'm talking about, you know, I've almost died 2 to 3 different times in my life, almost drowned twice. I had testicular cancer when I was 24 years old. I've been through two different divorces. I've had two foreclosures. I've been to a point many times where I've been in my car scrounging up change to buy a McDouble and a glass of water at McDonald's. You know, I've you know, been through a lot of difficulties. I've lost 5 children. And so my oldest child passed away from neuroblastoma cancer when she was 2 on Christmas Day in 2001 during my time with the Jets. So when I say I've had things that try to knock me down, you know, it's been a constant traveling through, you know, the deepest of valleys and some mountains along the way. You know, just so I do give all the glory to God as far as, you know, continuing to keep that perseverance and that confidence and that vision, because there's times where, I mean, just to kind of put this in context, back in 2013, I came home to a Dear John letter waiting for me on the table, and my second wife had said, you know, I need some time to think about this, and I came home, and my 4 kids, my living children at the time, were gone. And so I went through a year of, wow. If I can say it, of pure hell. You know, it was like you come home and your family just disappears. And And I went through a season of such depression and grief, and you know, everything was just the way they had left it around the house. And I haven't talked about this on the other show, but you know, I came closer, Jason, to giving up than I ever have in my life. You know, I got on my knees and begged God to end my life. Even I wasn't going to do it myself, but I didn't even, you know, I was to that point. And then right at the point where the divorce papers came and it was solidified that my children were 1,700 miles away in Minnesota, I was living in Arizona at the time. You know, all of a sudden, you know, my friend says to me, "Hey, you know, we should check out that church service, you know, down this town." And I said, "Ah, you know," and he says, "Well, let's go, let's just check it out." And we went there, and that's where I met my wife, Samantha, who's my wife now. And, you know, and she was able to breathe such love and such hope back in my life. I mean, it was like CPR. I mean, I was practically done. You know, I didn't even. You know, I was working a sales job at the time. I'd gone from number three in the company of 132 sales reps down to being on a verbal warning for non-production. I mean, I was spiraling out of control. So I don't always pull myself through or always have that ability. So when I say God gives me that ability, the kinds of things that I've been through, that the fact that I'm not truly in an insane asylum and I have this continued vision and confidence and these type of things that have been instilled in me, that's where it's got to come from. Because at times I've been like, wow, it's just too much to even process or even reconcile.
Wow, Daniel, that is, that's powerful. The thought that immediately just came to my mind is, you know, God doesn't promise that we're not going to go through trials and tribulations, but it sounds to me like when you were going through yours, he put somebody in your life that you needed at that time, your friend who said, "Hey, let's go check out church." And then you met your wife that you have today. I mean, that just proves right there, dude, he's got our back. You know, it doesn't matter what Absolutely. We're going through, he's got our back. And I can't think of a better teammate in life than God himself.
Absolutely. And that's been the case my whole life. You know, people say, well, you know, I'm not that smart to even dream up 99.99% of the stuff that I've done in my life. I mean, like people have brought my path. I mean, I'm 9 years old and I go to an airport and there's Jim Brown, you know, and I got his autograph, or I'm 21 years old and all of a sudden I'm working an insurance job. And all of a sudden there's an ad on the radio station that, you know, you call in, you can be on a mock draft. And all of a sudden I end up there and Tony Dungy's sitting at a table right next to the speaker. And there, it's always been somebody there. And the ideas even that got me into the NFL with the Jets came through other people that he put in my path. So you're right. You're right, Jason. I've had an army full of people been put in my life that have helped me, carry me when I needed it. And it's very humbling to think about.
It is. It's amazing. You know, 8 weeks ago, I didn't have a podcast. Here I am 8 weeks later. I have a podcast and I'm talking to a former scout of the New York Jets. You know, like, this for me has been amazing. This is why I do podcasts, is to meet guys like you. I have had fantastic guests so far, and man, you are an awesome guy, man.
Thank you, Jason. You are too. This is a very cool experience. Amazing how things open up like that. It's like it happened to me like this last two weeks ago. I reached out to Mad Dog Radio, and all of a sudden I'm being interviewed the next two nights later by Linda Cohn. All of a sudden, who's a broadcasting legend, you know, and all of a sudden from ESPN, the anchor for years, and then I reached out to the Detroit Lions, Sports Illustrated, and reached out, you know, to see if they would, you know, what, be interested in having me on the show. And all of a sudden, now I'm writing for SI Detroit Lions. So I know what you mean. Things can develop very quickly when like my mentor, Lionel Vitale, who's a Dallas Cowboys college director, says, "Danny, if it's for you, you're going to get it." And so with you, with starting your podcast, the wheels are turning in the right direction very quickly. The same things are happening for me. Doors are flying open. And when doors fly open, I've learned I'm smart enough. I'm not that smart, but I'm smart enough to know the walkthrough.
There you go. That's good advice. That's great advice.
Me too.
do you ever pinch yourself and go, man, is this really happening? This is just awesome. You know, you'd mentioned the interview with SI.
All the time. When I look back to my story, when I look back at my story in my book, Whatever It Takes, right? It's literally, I got to pinch myself. It's literally like reading somebody else's story. I've had numerous moments like that in my life where I'm sitting there like I'm just, you know, sitting at the NFL scouting combine, and I look over to sitting right directly to the right is Eric Dickerson, and right to my left is Al Davis, and I'm sitting here watching the practices, you know, and it's been so many moments like that, or, you know, all of a sudden, you know, just being at the interview with the Jets, you know, like it was a star-studded staff, and part of my interview, I'm typing up a scouting report on a player, the door opens in and walks Bill Parcells, or the last part of my interview, Bill Belichick walks in the room and sits down and talks with me about football players. So there's been many moments like that in my life where it's just like, I do have to pinch myself because it's like, wow, this is really happening, and this is really happening to me. I continue to have moments like that all the time, to your point, Jason. It's really, truly a blessing, that's for sure.
Your story is, we're going to get into scouting now. Your story is fantastic. You know, you went from being a fan of the NFL, just like I am, just like a lot of our listeners are, probably all of them, otherwise they wouldn't be listening, right?
But right.
You went from being a fan of the NFL to working in the NFL. You were actually hired as a scout for the New York Jets. But when did you have a goal of becoming an NFL scout?
When I was 17. It hit me. I got a book. You know, the books have been a big source of inspiration in my life. Joe Gibbs wrote a book called Fourth and One that inspired me. As a matter of fact, Joe Gibbs is the greatest influence in my life. That much of how I wrote my book is modeled after him. But I was given a book when I was 17, a little bit later, a few years later, called Tony Rizzano's Secrets NFL Scout, written by the 49ers' great personnel director. And I tell you what, Jason, it was like I couldn't put it down. I was like, you know, 17 years old, my parents gave it to me for my birthday. I said, I'm going to be an NFL scout. I started running around school telling all the kids, I'm going to be an NFL scout. You know, I told my dad, I told everybody, listen, I'm going to be an NFL scout. And so I knew at that point, because his book resonated so deeply with me, that I was like, this is it. It was just like one of those moments where it's just like, it's like intersecting with destiny.
So take us through the story of being a fan, you know, just being a fan of the game and actually becoming a scout for the New York Jets.
Yeah, absolutely, Jason. I mean, like I said before, you know, it's just a burning passion for the NFL and for football, specifically for the Washington Redskins, that it was just like it propelled me. If I wasn't talking about the Redskins, I was thinking about them. I wasn't thinking about them. I was talking, you know, dreaming about them. If I was dreaming about them, I was reading about them. I mean, I called my grandma every night after school. She answered the phone. You know, I talked to her about the Redskins for 2-3 hours. It got to the point where the first thing she did, she told me, was go for the sports section in the paper because I got so into it. You know, so it just kind of propelled me, and I think, you know, being that passionate about the game just kind of propelled me, if you will, in that direction, because I was all about it. I was all in all the time, and that's all I ever wanted to do. You know, matter of fact, I mean, when I would start, my first job was bagging groceries at a grocery store when I was 15 and a half. I worked at McDonald's as a cook. I worked at some different fast food places, and I never stick too long in any job, and because my passion, it was just like I was so one track that I just want to be in the NFL. And I would tell people when I got fired and stuff, they'd be like, oh, I don't care. One day I won't be in the NFL. So it just kind of kept propelling me. And then opportunities and people, you know, people ask me all the time, they say, what must I do to get in the NFL? I must have been asked that question hundreds of times over the last few years.
I'll bet.
And absolutely. And I say it's two things. Number one, pay very special attention to the ideas that just come to your mind out of nowhere. And number two, pay very special attention to the ideas, the people that are brought into your path. And so that's the way it's happened for me. So the passion, the burning, the pure raw fire, right, Jason? That was there all along. But it's just like my path, my life versus Proverbs 16:9. In his heart, a man plans his ways, but the Lord orders his steps. And I had some ideas. At 17, I drew up a play for Joe Gibbs when he was the head coach of the Redskins. He's now in the Hall of Fame. And I drew up a play suggestion and sent it to him, and he actually used it. It's in my book. As a matter of fact, the letter from Joe Gibbs thanking me for my play suggestions in my book, Whatever It Takes. And he actually used my play, and it worked for a touchdown against the Atlanta Falcons in a preseason game in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
How old were you when that happened?
17.
You were 17 years old and wrote a play for Joe Gibbs, and he actually used it, and it worked.
It worked. I was sitting in a sports bar watching the game, and I remember the play. It was play action, because the Joe Gibbs' bread and butter, if you remember back in the 80s, was that counter gap, counter tray play, the counter tray, where you know the running back would take a step to the left, and then the backside guard and tackle would start pulling right as lead blockers, and then come back to the right, and then take the handoff, and so that was his bread and butter. The counter tray or counter gap was Joe Gibbs' bread and butter play. And they've been using it for so many years. I said, you know, dear Coach Gibbs, here's what I think we should do, right? Is you know, everybody expects it. Everybody, you know, as soon as they see the backside guard and tackle start to pull, you know, the safeties suck up. Everybody starts to suck up towards that running play, right? So I said, why don't we do this? Why don't we take backside slot receiver Ricky Sanders, right, and use it in the post? And so do the same thing, the counter gap fake, but play action off of it instead of handing it off. You know, put the ball in your head, the quarterback's hip, and then send, as soon as the safety starts to suck up towards the line of scrimmage, you stop the run, you drag Ricky Sanders, the backside slot, up against the, deep on the, and it worked beautifully. I mean, the safety came up just like that, and the quarterback just, boom, and it hit Ricky Sanders for a large touchdown in a preseason game. And they used that same play in Super Bowl 22. They did. So it was a very cool play. But it was just like I was trying to say, Jason, it was just had that pure fire along with different people that were brought into my path, you know, with different opportunities that were brought into my path that kind of intersected on my journey and on my path, if you will, led me to the NFL. And I definitely didn't do it by myself. It was a journey. That's the only way I could describe it.
So this is interesting. I want to just stay on this just for a second. So you draw up a play, you send it to Joe Gibbs. So you see this play while you're in a bar?
Yeah, in a sports bar. I jumped up, I said, that's my play. And this guy, this older guy said, the bar is like, right. I was like, it is.
So when you saw the play, you knew there was no other way. I mean, he had to have used it. That was your play.
He did. And it's happened to me a few other times too in the NFL with something like that's happened without me telling anybody. But that specifically, that was my play. I jumped up. I said, that's my play. And Ricky Sanders with the touchdown. And it was an incredible moment for me as a young man.
Man, I wish you would have sent a couple letters to Freddie Kitchens last year. We could have used some good plays like that.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you were young. You're 17 years old. Do you feel like because you're young, you didn't have the fear that we would have as we were older? You know, because now you have more responsibilities. You have cars, mortgages, kids, wives. Do you feel like that was one of the ingredients is no fear when you're young of becoming an NFL scout?
Absolutely. I do. It was a knowing, and I just moved towards it with everything I had. But yeah, I never thought it was impossible. To me, Jason, impossible has always been just a word in the dictionary. It's a mindset. It's something where we limit ourselves based on our own doubts and our own fears. But yeah, as a young man, I had no doubt. I told anybody who would listen, I'm going to be an NFL scout.
Yeah, I mean, because I feel like the older you get, the more, it's a higher likelihood that you're going to have that fear because you do have more response. You know, like when I was young, when I was 18, 19 years old, no wife, no kids, it was okay for me to skip a meal or two. You know, it didn't matter. But now, you know, I find myself taking less risks than I did when I was, you know, that young. So I was just curious if that was part of your mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't feel any fear when it came to that. I was sure it was going to happen. I mean, people thought it was out of my mind, but I mean, if you saw my high school yearbook, it's just filled with Redskins suck, you know, Dan, and by the way, you're never going to become an NFL scout. So I never had any doubt whatsoever that eventually that was going to be a scout. That's all I ever wanted to do.
So that was my next question. You had some people telling you were crazy.
Yeah. All the time. Yeah, matter of fact, yeah. We'll get into more of that later when we talk about the Browns GM journey. But I've had a lot of people along the way that, to me, my critics are the greatest cheerleaders in the world. I love my critics. If I could have a few million more, I would take them in a heartbeat. I want everybody in the world to tell me I can't do something. I want people to tell me it's impossible. I want me to tell me I'm stupid, dumb. I want every line at every talk show in Cleveland and all across America to line up and say, this guy is crazy. Because being crazy to me is a compliment. It's the greatest compliment I can ever receive. And a lot of people along the way said that stuff. And all it really did for me, Jason, is just fueled me even more towards it because I knew I was on the right path. The more people told me that I was was nuts, crazy, out of my mind. I the more it propelled me. It was just something about it.
All right, so you're 17 years old. You have a plan, a dream, a vision of being an NFL scout. When did you get your first break?
Really, when I was 21 is when it first came about. I was, you know, I again, you know, and I want our listeners to really catch this because, you know, so often in life when we think of our dreams, you know, we think that, you know, there's a belief set out there that says we have to know somebody or we have to have a certain kind of education or we have to, you know, we have to come from a certain kind of background or, you know, or know the right people. And that's just not the way it happened for me. I mean, I barely passed through high school. And I failed off a very small community college because I you know was so into football and you know so it was something where and as far as playing football I was so terrible at playing as a junior in high school that I was the only kid on my team not to earn a letter. I didn't have enough playing time even a letter and so I was only kid. My claim to fame was dropping interception when we were down like 40 to nothing with 2 minutes left of the game. Coach put me in the game and the ball went right through my hands, hit me in the helmet, and bounced to the ground. And Linda Cohen, matter of fact, when I was on her show, she said, well, don't be too hard on yourself. That was more like a pass defended or something like that. So I was like, you know, hey, Linda was the first person ever put a positive spin on it for me. So I enjoyed that. But you know, but it really, you know, so my background was you know, from a small town in Minnesota. And so my first big break came, Jason, when I was 21. And I found myself working at Allstate Insurance as an insurance agent and telemarketing for insurance leads. And one night, a radio show, was on a sports radio show, a KFAN radio in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And they said, first 32 callers call in and you can represent a team on the air here on the radio station. We're going to be hosting a mock draft party at the Minnesota Vikings headquarters in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Call now. And they, you know, they gave the phone number. Well, I had 9 open phone lines, Jason. So I started dialing. Like, I was like, I was a fast
this
dialer.
This is a job for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started dialing and they said, congratulations, your second caller. You're going to represent the Jacksonville Jaguars in our mock draft on the radio. So I walked in there. I took all my scout reports. I had sent into Redskins GM at the time, Charlie Cassidy, trying to land an internship. And, you know, I was scared to death. I walked up to the microphone, just like the commissioner sounds. You know, they said, well, you know, welcome back. You know, they came back from the commercial break and they said, you know, with the second pick in the 1995 draft, the Jacksonville Jaguars select. And I reached into the microphone and I said, Tony Boselli, offensive tackle, USC. And I looked out of the corner of my eye, Jason, and I saw Tony Dungy sitting there as a defensive coordinator of the Minnesota Vikings. And he was all by himself. And you know, and so I approached him. It just it's something inside me said, go up to him. And so I did. And so I walked up to him. I said, hey, Coach Dungy, you know, here's all my old scouting reports. I did trying to get an internship with Washington. I said, would you be willing to look at these? And I introduced myself. He said, sure. And he sat there for a good 5-10 minutes thumbing through the reports, looking. He goes, you know what? This stuff is pretty good. He goes, how would you feel about coming to my office next week? We sit down. I can pull out some of my old reports with the Kansas City Chiefs. We can talk and we can go, you know, go from there. How would you like that? And I'm like, yeah, I think I'm available.
Yeah.
So I called in sick, right? I called in sick the next week and went in there. That turned into be a 6-month unpaid internship with Coach Dungy. And so that was my first big break where, you know, I'd go in there, we'd talk about football. He would give me some assignments. He would talk about faith. He would talk to me about life. He would teach me some lessons. And that was really my first big break in the NFL was, you know, Tony Dungy taking a liking to me and recognizing my work because a lot of my reports lined up exactly with his reports. And that really built up my confidence too, that have an NFL guy like that, a defensive coordinator in the NFL under Danny Green say, you know what, I think this stuff is pretty good. That really let me know that I was on the right track for sure. Like this is really, you know, I could do this.
What a great man Dungy is, and a great first start that you had with him for sure. And what Absolutely. Team was that?
That was with the Minnesota Vikings back when he was a defensive coordinator, Danny Green, back before he went to Tampa because he left for Tampa. I went back to the real world of selling Kirby vacuum cleaners and stuff door to door. And that was right before the Buccaneers job for him.
Gotcha. So fast forward to, because you were obviously a scout for the New York Jets. How did that come about?
That was a wild experience. Like I said, I went through a really rough time between 21 and 24. I went through a big breakup with my first fiance, ended up being evicted from my apartment. My vehicle was repossessed. I even spent a day in jail for having a suspended driver's license for unpaid tickets as a dumb young man. I didn't pay my tickets, and it's one thing kind of snowballed into another. And, I was going to a different bar every night, trying to find the answers of life at the bottom of a bottle. And I was going through a rough time living on a buddy's couch. And this is kind of the backdrop before the Jets thing happened. And I found myself at 24 working at Bank of America Mortgage as a loan officer. And I'd never been in real estate before in my life. And I'm sitting there I got the job and I was newly married at the time. And I was seeing a real estate law meeting. And, maybe one of our listeners or some of our listeners now can relate. But I was really like, what am I doing here? My dream is to be an NFL scout, and it's better than me, Jason. It was better than me to go for it, because my philosophy in life was really forged by Joe Gibbs in Super Bowl 17 on 4th-and-1, where a lot of young coaches would have, punted, lived to see another day. I mean, Goliath, quote unquote, Don Shula's on the other sideline, legendary coach. You're a second year head coach. Nobody really knows your name yet. It's 4th-and-1. And he made the decision to go for it. And based on that gutsy call, when all the chips were up on the table, and we talk about what happened. Well, John Riggins ran for a touchdown that play, and the rest is history, and they're all in the Hall of Fame. But that was not a given at the time. But that forged my philosophy is to have that aggressive attitude that to go for it. And so I sat during that real estate meeting at 24 years old at Bank of America, Jason. I said, it's better to go for it and not get it than to be one of those guys sitting in the bar stool one day and say, I could have been a contender. I didn't want to be that guy. Ideas start popping in my mind. I got a little satellite dish. I can record the games. I'll give my dream one last chance with the Redskins. And so I kind of made that resolution that day in that meeting. And sure enough, I called DirecTV, subscribed to their package, their college football package, got all the pens and paper that I could buy. And I started, recording games. And that turned into being quite a process for the next 7 months. The reports started stacking up, and it turned into be a I wrote a 1998 I self-published a 1998 NFL draft report. It was a 350 page quote-unquote resume I made. I spent $2,300 on it, put all my reports in there, put all my handwritten notes in there as well, so nobody would think I copied Mel Kiper, one of these draft experts. I personalized every book to every one to every GM in the NFL, one to every head coach, and one to every director of player personnel. I put all my money, all my time into it, and I got done with it by April 1st, and then I got a credit account with an overnight mail company, and I express mailed about 8-pound boxes off northeast, south, and west as my resume, and that's when it happened. So I put everything into it, and I want people to hear this with no guarantees whatsoever. It was like Joe Gibbs on that 4th-and-1 call. I put everything I had into it, and just waited to see what would happen.
$2,300 was a lot of money to you, I'm sure, back then. I mean,
it was everything.
It was everything. What gave you the idea to do that? I mean, to publish basically a resume and send it off to all 32 NFL teams.
Well, it's wild you ask that, Jason, because it really wasn't my idea at all. Because I had these reports stacking up, and I took a break one night about 2 o'clock in the morning to get some pizza rolls. And there was a special on TV on ESPN about Wayne Corbett. You remember him, the receiver from out of Hofstra for the Jets. He was an undrafted free agent, right? And in this story, I'm eating munching on the pizza rolls, watching this story, and I'm sitting there, and it talks about, how his dad, sent a highlight tape of his son out to all the teams in the NFL to land his son an opportunity. And that's really when the light bulb moment happened for me. It's like, I've only tried to get with the Redskins. I've never tried again with the other team in the league. So I said, well, I'm going to do it. I'm going to send my reports out to all the teams in the league. At that moment, at 2 o'clock in the morning, Northeast Minneapolis, an old rundown duplex, I had that epiphany, if you will. But I still didn't know how I was going to package this stuff. So it's like, well, I'll put it in 3-ring binders, but I had this thought, well, no, because they'll probably take out the reports. The teams will throw the reports away and use the binders for something else. So the next day, how we talked about earlier, right? How people are put into your path, right? And the advice I give people, I had a friend at the time named Michael Williams. He was a guy who was in my training class, and I'm sitting here telling him this story, just like I'm sharing with you and all of our listeners right now. And he says to me, well, why don't you get your reports published into a book format? And I'm like, well, how do you do that? He said, well, get a phone book and start calling publishers. And so I did. So it wasn't even my idea. Again, it came through somebody else. And so I started calling all the publishers in the area. And one guy liked the story. He liked what I was trying to do. He said, listen, I like this. I like your goal. He said, it's going to be $2,300. It's going to take about 85,000 sheets of paper, which is equivalency of 3 trees. But I'm going to do it for you. I'm going to do it because I believe in your vision, believe what you're trying to do. And I think he gave me a discount too, you know, at that rate even. But that was all the money I had, plus my next 2 paychecks. I don't even pay rent that month. I fell even further behind my bills because it was just a matter of going for it. But, you know, so that's how the idea came about to even do that book in the first place. And then once I got into the NFL, the crazy part about the story, you want to hear the craziest part about the story?
Yeah, that's what. For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't touch that dial to our listeners. I mean, it's the craziest part of the story. So all these months later, probably about 8-9 months later, right? I'm sitting in the AFC divisional playoff game, Jets versus Jaguars, kind of a mountaintop moment for me. Jets win. They're going on to the championship game at the Meadowlands. The confetti's coming down from the stadium. You know, up next, AFC championships flashing the scoreboard. You know, I'm thinking we're going to the Super Bowl. And there's probably about 70,000 people in the stadium. And I had gone through testicular cancer my first season in the NFL. I had 2 major operations. And so it was a grueling, emotional, incredible, amazing. It was all that wrapped in the one season for me. And so I was just kind of sitting there. I had a few tears in my eyes. I'm watching the confetti. It's like a movie moment. And this man turns around to me. He says, that sure was a great game. And I said, yeah, it was. And I was sitting about 50-yard line, about, you know, probably about 15, 20 rows up. And again, there's 70,000 people in the stadium. And I said, I reached out my hand. I said, hey, by the way, it's nice to meet you. I'm Dan Kelly. I'm a scout with the Jets. And he says, I'm Wayne Corbett Sr. Nice to meet you.
Oh, wow.
Sitting right directly.
Talk about full circle, huh?
See, I'm sitting right directly in front of me out of 70,000 people, the man whose story about his son who inspired me, the son I work out to all the teams in the NFL, way back when I was writing my reports, you know, 8-9 months earlier about my, you know, having this dream of going for my dream and scouting in the NFL. And the guy ends up exactly, Jason, sitting right in front of me in the stadium. It was surreal.
That's what I call a God wink.
Absolutely.
You know, that's God winking down at you saying, see, I told you, I got you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, here's proof.
That stuff can't be scripted. That stuff is, I love that, a God wink.
Oh, man. Wow. All right. So what year was that with the Jets that you went to the AFC championship game?
That was my first season in 98.
Your first season in 98. So obviously of all the resumes you sent out, your published books, one of 32 teams called you, the New York Jets, and who actually hired you? Who did you sit down and interview with?
My interview came down to, it was a star-studded interview. It was a 2-day marathon process, interview with a lot of different people. My interview started with, when I walked in the building, I walked right past it's on the front cover of my book, Whatever It Takes, the Super Bowl trophy from Super Bowl III. I walked in, that was the first thing I saw. They ushered me into to a meeting room to meet with Dick Haley, who was the architect of the Pittsburgh Steelers dynasty in the 70s, who drafted Terry Bradshaw, Mean Joe Green, Lynn Swan, John Stallworth, all those guys, and that was my first. I mean, he's a legend in the NFL, one of the most revered evaluators in history. And that was my first part of my interview. And I sat down with him at a table and talked football, which was an incredible experience. He took me into the war room, asked me my opinion of which teams I thought did well or which didn't, and, you know, had a chance. And the most ironic part about me getting hired at the Jets is I actually, in my 1998 draft book, Jason, I actually had their top draft pick that year, Dorian Booz. They drafted him high in the second round. Well, in my draft report, I had him rated as an undraftable reject.
Really?
So Mr. Haley, Dick Haley, who's of course Todd Haley's dad, you know, he wanted to, you know, ask my opinion why I thought their top draft pick was a bust before he even took the field. And so that was kind of an interesting, somewhat uncomfortable, but he made a comfortable moment in the draft room where I had a chance to talk to a scouting legend about, you know, my thoughts on their top draft pick. So it was kind of wild to me. I even got hired by the Jets after having that report in my book, but I did. And so I interviewed with him for a while, went to dinner with Scott Pioli, who we've seen on TV, on NBC, of course. He's a former GM of the Kansas City Chiefs. He used to be assistant GM of the Falcons, NFL executive a decade with the Patriots, of course, and he's Bill Parcells' son-in-law. He was my big partner.
The 95 Browns. Is that, remember the documentary they did on TV?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah,
I think
yeah,
he was one of the Slappies. They called him the Slappies.
Yeah, yeah, that's him. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's him. So you're right. I went to dinner with him and JoJo Wooden, who's now the player personnel director with the Chargers. For dinner that night, my first night. The next morning, the wake up call came early. Went down to breakfast with Mike Tannenbaum. He wanted to talk all about my knowledge of the salary cap and the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement. They ushered me back to the building. Then I sat down, met with. Eric Mangini was the next part of my interview. I sat down with
another Slappy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he started his career in the equipment room picking up jock straps, as they like to joke about.
I remember part of the show they were all living in the same apartment, and Eric Mangini had the idea of maybe getting cable, and I forget who it was. They're like, "Are you kidding?"
I think George Kokainis was with them too. I think back then.
Was he really?
Yeah, it was all those young guys were together. They all rented a place together. Yeah.
Oh man, that's awesome.
Yeah, it is. It is. So I sat down with Coach Mangini, and he turned over my book, Jason, in the back of my 1998 draft book, the 350-page resume that I sent into the Jets that got me this far. I had written on the back, "All I ask for is an opportunity," in quotes. And Coach Mangini, he was our DBs coach at the time of the Jets, he said, "So tell me, Dan, what would an opportunity in the NFL mean to you?" And I said, "Coach Mangini, it'd mean everything." And I just kind of leaned into him like that. He said, "Okay. Okay, that's good." and of course, he had all the plays all diagrammed on all the grease boards in his office and everything. Of course, he was Belichick's, he was Belichick's guy back then. And so then I went from that part of the interview. Then they wanted me to evaluate Rick Lyle, who was the defensive player for the defensive lineman at the time, just to kind of get my, thoughts on Rick. And so they put me in a film room. I watched six games on him, took notes, wrote up a report, and then they took me into a room and set me in front of a computer. And right when I started to type the report, in walks Bill Parcells in the room, and he introduces himself. He's like, "I'm Bill Parcells." I'm like, "I know who you are." I said, "You're the guy they dumped Gatorade over your head back in the 80s. And he kind of chuckled a little bit, and he said, "Listen, I just really want an opportunity to say hello to you, meet you, shake your hand." He goes, "Hey, you never know. We might see you around here again sometime." So I love that, Coach. And so by that time, my head just it's going a mile a minute. And I sit down, I finish my report. And then at that point, Scott Pioli asked me to give him a call when I was done with the report. He said, "Okay." I called him. He said, "Make three copies and come to my office." I'm like, one for Scott, one for me. Who's the third one for?" I'm like, "Oh no." I said, "Please don't let it be Rick Lyle." Right. And I mean, I thought they're going to call the player from the locker room. I'm like, "Please don't let this happen to me." Right. So I walk in the room, and it's kind of like you've seen the movie Draft Day. Right. And it's just that kind of, that office, it's kind of that the big windows overlooking the practice field with the pristine fluorescent yellow goalpost. And I walk into Pioli's office and he says, "Here, have a seat." And his desk is sitting there, two chairs in front of it. He says, "Have a seat." And all of a sudden he lifts up the phone. He goes, "Okay, he's in here. Would you join us, please?" And click. And I'm like, "Okay, who's this going to be next?" Right. And then walks Bill Belichick.
And my goodness.
And that's what my interview came down to, was Scott Pioli, Bill Belichick, and me sitting in a room in his office. They shut the door, and Scott handed one copy of my report to Belichick. He kept one and gave one to me. And Belichick put on these glasses he had. He started reading it, and it seemed like an eternity. It probably was only a couple minutes. But it was like, and he took off the glasses. He said, "This is what we asked Rick to do. He's a guy that's a dependable veteran. We run a 3-4 defense. He's not a guy who's going to make a lot of flashy plays, but he's a guy that we can count on to hold the point of attack so the linebackers can scrape it and make plays." So you have a nice report. And I said, "Well, thank you." And he started asking me questions. Bill Check started asking me questions about my extensive film library, of all the tapes, the games I had recorded to do my book in the first place. So I told him all about that. And he looked at me, and he just stared at me for a moment. And I looked at him and stared back, of course. I'm sitting right next to him. And he says, "So tell me, Dan." He goes, "What would an opportunity mean to you in the NFL?" And I looked him dead square in the eyes without blinking. I said, "Coach Belichick, it would mean everything to me." I said, "I will do whatever it takes to succeed here." And I just stared him in the eyes. And neither one of us blinked for a good 5-10 seconds. And he said, "Okay." He said, "Well, thanks for coming out to New York. We'll be in touch." And the guy that was going to take me to the airport was staying at the door. And I left without a job offer. And I'm like, okay. I'm like, this is kind of like the end of a movie without an ending, right? So this is kind of anticlimactic, what's going to happen? And, I flew back to Minnesota at the time. And, then 2 weeks later, a week and a half later, actually, the call came from Scott Pioli, the call just like in draft day, we see with the players. And that's when, the call, the phone rang, and I saw a 516 area code and knew it was Scott. And I answered. He said, Dan, he goes, Bill's reached a decision on you. And I said, okay. And he said, I get choked up even thinking about to this day. And he said, first I need to talk to you about a couple things. I said, okay. Okay. He said, first of all, he goes, I wasn't able to get a lot of money approved for you. He goes, because that's the way they came up in Cleveland, right? I mean, you earn your stripes. He said, I was able to get $21,000 approved for your first year. Now, I know that's not a lot of money, but, what we'll do is I'll throw in a Hofstra food card so you can get your meals for free over there and a couple season tickets. And more than that, I need to talk to you about some things. He goes, number one, overtime in the NFL is not, something that's optional, it's required. And he goes, I know you're newly married, and I know that, NFL hours can be tough on new marriages. So if you need some time to think about it, I'm like, Scott, I don't need any time. And I said, are you asking? He said, I am. And I said, I accept. He goes, congratulations, you're the newest member of the New York Jets. Wow. And I cried. I hung up the phone. I jumped all around and I called my grandmother, who was my biggest supporter, is really the woman who always let me know that nothing's impossible and always supported my dream. I get choked up. I'm getting choked up. I'm not even thinking back about it, Jason. It was just that moment that we see on TV, when the players get called. It was just incredible. It was just a dream came true at that moment. And they ushered me out there to the mini camp, and I found myself staying in the dorms with all the incoming rookies. Scott Frost, who's the head coach, of course, Nebraska now, he was a defensive back that came in. All these guys are coming in. They're all playing video games. I'm walking past the room. I'm like, wow, I'm in the NFL. This is pretty cool.
I was just getting ready to say it probably was very similar to getting a phone call when a player is drafted, not in the first, second, third, fourth round, because they pretty much know the call's coming, but the seventh round picks, the guys that don't exactly know the phone's going to ring, and then all of a sudden it does ring and they get offered a job in the NFL. That's probably a lot of the emotions that you were feeling at that time, right?
Absolutely. Just even talking about brings me right back to it to this day.
I can tell. Daniel, the passion's still there, man. I can see it. I can see it. The passion's still there. There's not a little fire. There's a big fire burning in your chest. So
absolutely.
You're right, Jason. You were employed by two, what I call intimidating coaches, all business, right? When you think of Belichick and you think of Parcells, that's what I think about as a fan. What was that like working for not one of them, but both of those coaches? they expect nothing but excellence from everybody, from the guy sweeping the floors to the guy calling the plays. What was it like working for guys like that?
Intense. That's the word that comes to mind. Intense. Yeah. They were known throughout the building, Jason, as Big Bill and Little Bill affectionately, by those who had a lot more seniority than me. So I never called them that. I never said, hey, Little Bill. I say no. But it was super intense. And you're right. It was something where there was an atmosphere of excellence. Bill Parcells had a saying that act like you've been there before. It was a very highly experienced. It was arguably the best staff in NFL history. We had seven coaches go on to become head coach at the college or NFL level. Like I mentioned, I was on staff with Pioli. I was on staff with Tannenbaum. I was on staff with DeKalb. I was on staff. And those are the big names that some of the more tenured people that we know of. All the young guys I broke in with in the NFL during my 4 years there have all gone on to become directors and GMs or types in the NFL. I mean, I worked on staff with Brian Gain. He came in 2 years after me. He became the GM of the Houston Texans. He's up in Buffalo now. I was on staff with JoJo Wood. He's a director of player personnel with the Chargers. I was on staff with Trent Baalke. He went on to become the GM of the 49ers. I was on staff. My mentor is Lionel Vitale. He's a scout, the college scouting director now at the Dallas Cowboys. There's just the list goes on of guys. Chris Shea, who I trained into my position of pro scouting when I left or was leaving. He's the pro scouting director of the the Super Bowl champion Kansas City Chiefs currently. So, I mean, we had a star-studded staff, and it was just it ran Jason like a well-oiled machine is the best way to describe it. It was extremely organized. It was a very high level of accountability built into everything you did. Parcells had a saying, one wrong, all wrong. So whenever I would make a mistake on a roster, it couldn't be depended on. And so I got called into Scott Pioli's office quite a few times. If I made even a smallest mistake, it was pointed out to me, to an effort to get better. A second best wasn't settled for in that building. I remember one of my moments, I remember quite a bit. I talked about my book, Whatever It Takes, was Scott Pioli, JoJo Wood, and me went down to the NFL Europe back when that was going on. Down Orlando in Florida. And we landed at the airport, and this was right after we lost the championship game a few months later. And, I was just, it was kind of uncomfortable. It was kind of a silence in the car. So I just kind of, Scott was sitting in the passenger seat. JoJo was sitting next to me in the back seat. And then I'm sitting there. And I just made a kind of a comment, just a simple comment. I said, last year sure was great. And, just kind of break the ice in the car. I said, we're one game short of Super Bowl. I said, that was pretty good. And the car just went silent. and Scott, being a bigger guy himself, broad shoulders, bigger guy, very, very well built. He kind of leans over from his chair, looks back at me and he says, I don't ever want to hear you say that again. He said, one game short isn't good enough. And the whole rest of the car, JoJo just kind of looked at me. I looked at him and nobody said another word the rest of the ride. And it was just a great reminder. And that's the atmosphere I worked in under those guys. And it's the atmosphere that produced victory. I mean, the first season I was with the Jets, Jason, was the first time in 29 years the Jets had won a title of any type. They had been kind of an outfit, an organization that didn't do too well for a lot of years. And so when Parcells came in there, he brought that high level of accountability. He broke up every clique in the building. He had Pioli going around basically keeping all the marketing and PR people and video people all of our department, the football section of the building. So it was a very highly structured environment. And Parcells, he changed the uniform almost immediately when he got there, if you recall. And they changed things and they demanded the highest excellence, the highest standards possible. And I worked in that environment day in and day out, probably 12, 16, 18, 20 hours a day sometimes for the first 2 years before Belichick and Pioli and all the guys went up to New England. Then after I left for the 4 years, as years have gone by, they've kind of gone back into the same mold they were in with the Richie Kotite years and all that before Parcells got there. But it was really just an incredible environment. It was an environment that was just loaded with Super Bowl rings. And it was an environment I really had an opportunity to work, like I said, with on the greatest staff in NFL history.
Well, what a blessing that you were thrown into that type of environment. There's a lot of GMs in the league, new GMs, that are put in that position to change the culture, change the atmosphere of the organization. And, I'm sure there's GMs looking for guys just like you to fit that mold of what they're trying to do.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. Yeah, I'd love to talk to him because it was a real privilege. It was a real privilege to learn from those guys and be around them because it wasn't just so much what they even said; it's what they did. So the having an idea of how to go about things and like Scott Pioli had a saying that he always said to me whenever I ran into a wall and I couldn't find information because information gathering was really the cornerstone of the operation. The saying around the building was gather it but never give it. But whenever I'd run into something and I couldn't find information, Scott Pioli would always say to me, exhaust your resources, Dan. And so I would keep digging and eventually I would find the information. And so just being around those guys and learning how to do that, absolutely. I'm sure, people in the NFL are looking to do that to this day because, all Belichick's, a lot of these teams in the NFL, a lot of these guys have gone on, are from his tree and from, Parcells' tree, sure, and from, Pioli's tree and Tannenbaum and up and beyond over that even. So a lot of guys in the NFL right now who are running teams come from that tree. So I would love the chance to step in and do it, that's for sure.
let's make it happen.
Absolutely.
What does a day in the life of a scout look like?
it's fun. It's fun. It's intense. There's always something to do. There is no off season. It's something where in the room I worked in, there was no windows and no clock. So you go in there in the morning and you'd walk out or forget to eat. It'd be dark and you'd be like, wow, what happened to the day? And it was a lot of, information gathering for me personally. Like I mentioned, a lot of administrative work, a lot of research projects, making highlight tapes and cut-ups, organizing things, organizing rosters, doing whatever they asked me to do. I one of my job duties was going to Hooters to pick up chicken wings and game planning night. And one time Parcells' secretary walked in and handed me two $100 bills, and I said, Linda, her name is Linda Leone. I said, Linda, we get these for half price, just to let you know. And she goes, I know. And she walked out, she had me the money. So it was $400 for the chicken wings. I had to go to the gate. So anything they asked me to do, I attended four straight scouting combines in Indianapolis. I attended league training at the NFL office down at Park Avenue, New York. Anything and everything they asked me to do, any kind of task, getting eggplant pizzas for Mike Tannenbaum, driving players to the airport, picking up free agents, you name it. I did it. It was a little bit of everything my first 2 years. And then my third year, once Pioli and Belichick and all those guys left for up to New England, at that point, they made me their special teams scout, which I believe I was the first special teams scout in NFL history. And I wrote another 350-page book evaluating every kickoff return, punt return player in the league, and developed a revolutionary system that I think can build the best special teams in the NFL, as well as the best depth on a team. And it was recognized a few years ago by Bobby April. He said, who's a revered special teams coach in the NFL with the Eagles at the time, and he said it was excellent three times in the first 2 minutes I talked to him. So I put together that project as well, and I scouted other leagues, my fourth season, the Canadian Football League, the Arena Leagues, free agents. It was just so much I learned. Just being in that environment was just being around that was just was an incredible process, incredible experience, a memory of a lifetime, and I think it's prepared me for what's to come.
How many scouts are typically employed by an NFL team?
Usually in the pro side, in the pro scouting side, we had myself, JoJo, Scott, Mike Tannenbaum. We had a couple other interns and assistants coming in throughout the time. So, three, maybe four in the pro scouting department. And then the college side, just from memory, I think we had probably about nine or 10 college scouts, regional scouts. And we had, we had guys that were more experienced that would, kind of cross-check the younger guys. And then we had a college scouting coordinator who was John Griffin. And we had our director of player personnel was Dick Haley. So you're probably looking at, and we had a younger guy too, an intern type, making tapes at all times and cut-ups. We probably had 12, 13 in the college side any given time. So you're probably looking about, both pro and college, probably 17, 18 guys if you count the directors.
So, excuse my ignorance. So pro scouts, you would be scouting current NFL players.
Yeah, Jason, no, absolutely. There's so much involved. Don't feel bad. I learned so much when I was inside the game, just from it. So, yeah, pro scouting is looking at the free agents and also focusing on the advanced scouting process, which is a whole new world that my eyes were opening up to once I got into the department. So what the conference scout or the conference scouts will do in a pro department is they will advanced scout all the upcoming opponents for the team. And what I mean by that is they'll look at every player on the roster, and then they'll write up like philosophically what those teams are trying to do, go to the games before they play them, sit there and watch with binoculars, see if any guys are taped up in the pregame warmups favoring a hamstring, listening to the radio. Scott Peel used to have me, I did a couple trial runs where Scott would have me listen to an AM radio, listen to the pregame show, listen for any kind of information about, so-and-so tweaked the hamstring this week in practice, write it down, sit up there in the press box in these games. I sat in the press box at Giant Stadium, the Meadowlands, many times, doing like mock reports, and I'd be watching for the hand signals of the coordinators on the sidelines. So they'd hold up like a fist, and all of a sudden, as soon as they held up a fist, that meant they were going into their Detroit package, let's say, is what we called it. That meant they were going to have, three wide receivers, one tight end, one running back in the game. So every single time, that's the chess match you see as you're watching a game where, a team will hold up a fluorescent card, or they'll hold up a signal or something like that, and then they'll sub packages in. So they'll go to the three wide receiver package, four wide receiver package, package, you'll go to their heavy jumbo package on goal line. And then, you know, the defense, you know, reacts to that and sends in their nickel or their dime or their goal line defense or whatever they may be doing. So, you know, learning the hand signals, you know, sitting up in the booth, you know, reading the hand signals, listening to the information, watching everything, gathering all the information, all that goes into a pro scouting report. And that's presented to the coaching staff Monday mornings, typically of game planning week. And that information ties into the game planning process so they can take a look and see, you know, from a scouting standpoint, what the players do, how they do it, what they do philosophically. It's kind of like a briefing, if you will, you know, to coaching staff as they're starting to think about, okay, this week we got Miami. Okay, we got, you know, Scott Pioli in here, you know, the pro director. You know, let's talk about the Dolphins. And so Scott gives a briefing on what his work has been on the Dolphins, and that gears the coaches up to start making the game plan, if that makes sense.
So that does make sense.
That's a big part of it.
Yeah, I mean, so say like in your example, we're playing the Dolphins. Would you go to see a Dolphins game the week before, or a couple weeks before, or a couple weeks in a row? Or
yeah, 1 week. Now, I didn't do that because I was the youngest guy at the time in the department, but Scott Pioli primarily did those, and then JoJo, who's more tenure than me, did a couple each season, but Scott did most of it. Absolutely. So Scott would always be, you know, a week ahead of the team, and he'd be going to that game that week to kind of finish off his report so he could sit down Monday morning and give Parcells and the coaching staff a briefing, which was generally about 40 to 50 pages. I would sit in Scott's office. I would input all the jersey numbers of where all the guys lined up on special teams even, because, you know, all the guys, they wanted to know where they lined up, what they did, you know, who's going to be on, you know, inactive this week, or who's been inactive, so they could kind of like figure out, you know, the inactives maybe for that week. And so, yeah, they're all that information's in there, and that information helps the coaches start their game planning preparations for that week. So it's a very intense process. And that's another part of the pro scouting, that we had the free agency, of course, the free agency period, you know, in the springtime, you know, looking at all the players and, you know, maybe 200-300 free agents, and then making cut up tapes and highlight tapes. So all the guys, you know, the free agent players, we had to keep, boards, you know, like magnetic boards up on the walls, you know, of all the emergency shortlist guys. So if somebody broke their leg in training camp, hey, who are the available outside linebackers right now who to call? And, you know, they would be all up on a wall and everything. And we had all the rosters of all the teams in the NFL going down magnetic walls, you know, on all the teams and everything. So you could see who all the players were in the league, and maintaining the film library, and then going to the combine and supporting the college scouts in the scouting process of the NFL scouting combine in the springtime. Indianapolis was another role we played, and you know, helping Mike Tannenbaum with contract research. Tannenbaum would talk about how, you know, it's a club's responsibility, and Tannenbaum was brilliant when it came to numbers and contracts. So, you know, he would talk about how, you know, it's you know, agents like to try and negotiate subjectively, but it's a club's responsibility to negotiate objectively. And so we did a lot. I did a lot of research projects, and so, you know, like you know, an agent would come in and try to talk something about a player, and that information be used to our leverage, to be able to leverage in the negotiations process. So there was always something to do, always something to do. I mean, if there was 26 hours in a day, we would have found it.
I tell you, Daniel, this is fascinating. I mean, the average fan, I consider myself an average fan, I don't think about this kind of stuff in the game. You know?
I didn't either.
Yeah.
I had no idea. It was eye-opening for me to even be involved with it. It was incredible.
Yeah, honestly, when I think of a scout, I think of going to scout college football players that are into the draft, or maybe scouting free agents that are coming. I had no idea all this was going on.
So. Oh yeah, it's year round. There's no off season in the NFL. It's there's always something to do, Jason.
All right, so you were a scout really before the internet took off. You know,
absolutely.
In today's world, how do you think scouting in today's world is different from when you were scouting in the NFL?
I think today's scouting, I think the social media is a big part of the process. It wasn't a part of the process when I was there. Right now, every team in the NFL has got a guy or two or three that's digging into every single player's social media accounts, Facebook, Twitter. They want to know everything, any kind of gang affiliations, any kind of crazy posts. I mean, we saw last year with the Browns, so we saw that safety, you know, go haywire on Twitter, and then all of a sudden he gets cut. So they want to know what the guy, you know, who his friends our circle of friends, what he's doing, what he's posting about, what his thoughts are, because you can tell a lot about a person just by looking at their you know, social media. So I think that's the biggest adjustment that's been made since the time I was in the league, is the research that goes into social media.
That's awesome. I could probably talk to you all night. We're getting close to it, but getting into your book, Whatever It Takes, I haven't personally read the book, but I can promise you following this interview, I'm going to jump online and order it. I guess awesome. You would, I think I saw the link on your Twitter page. Is that how you can order the book?
Yeah. Yes, sir. Correct. Yep.
I'm definitely doing that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. You kind of went over what the book is about. Is there anything that else that you'd like to share about the book for our listeners who maybe haven't read it yet?
Absolutely. First of all, it's a book that's a lot more than just football. You know, that's a big thing. I mean, if you're a football fan, you'll get insight and looks into the NFL that you've never seen before. I mean, that I can tell you. But the book itself is in the back cover of the book. In the back cover, it says it's a story of perseverance and a message of hope. And that's really what the story is, because interwoven, like we've talked about tonight, Jason, it's having the ability to persevere through things and having the message of hope that you can get through anything in life can throw at you. And it's also a book that's written to let you know that your dream is possible. It can come true. In the book, when I wrote this book, I didn't just write it for me. This book is not just, hey, look at me. Look how great this is. Look what I accomplished. This book is about you. That's what this book is about. This book is about is helping you on your journey get to where you are going, because you have a purpose. You have a journey you're walking out. And this book is just, it's written for you to let you know that what you're trying to do is possible. Because I wasn't a guy that was hooked in at nepotism and cronyisms and all these different networks and knowing all these people. Like I said, I was a guy that you know, barely passed through high school, that barely made his high school football team. And I ended up on the best staff in NFL history. So the book is about letting you know really that nothing's impossible.
I can't wait to dig in that book. And honestly, I know you say it's about us, and it probably is, I'm sure, but man, your life can be a movie. It could be a Hollywood movie,
prophetic.
Man.
That's prophetic. That's something that's been shown to me. Matter of fact, my wife Samantha, the closing song is an Eminem song. Actually, I've already envisioned how the movie ends in the beginning of the movie, and I've already have certain segments of the movie, you know, like playing through my mind. And when we sit down in a movie theater to watch a movie, I actually have thoughts about the movie actually being on the screen. So it's funny you say that.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people can get a lot out of that book, because we've all had things that we've dealt with in life, and some are very extreme, and some, you know, we all just have challenges. And whatever it takes, the title, Whatever It Takes, is a mantra that I've adopted, you know, because it's like, whatever you are doing in life, you know, whatever goals that you have, it's not how much, you know, what do I have to put in my goal? No, it is whatever it takes. It's whatever it takes. It's however many hours I have to work to reach my goal. Hours don't even matter. It's just, I'm going to do whatever it takes to accomplish what I want to accomplish. And I'm sure that book spells it out better than I just did.
No, you did a great job with it, Jason. You're exactly right. Whatever It Takes is more than a title to a book. It is a way of life. And it's just, you know, I had an old boss that said, he used to have this famous saying with me. They always like to joke around me. He said, winners find a way to win. You know, and to me, it's like you'll find a way. Don't look at it, because a lot of times people look at what I don't have, right?
Right.
And they'll look at, well, I don't have enough money. I don't have this. Maybe I don't have the internet. Maybe I don't, you know, maybe I don't have the lights on right now. Maybe I can't afford the bills. Maybe I don't have a vehicle. I have to walk. Don't focus on what you don't have. Focus on what you do have. Let's say that you're a songwriter and you have all these things, these challenges out there. But if you have a piece of paper and a pen, you can start writing that song right now. You know, so it is whatever it takes. Whatever it takes means focusing on what you have that's been given to you, the blessing been given to you, and continue to put. Sometimes when we go through challenges, because you're right, Jason, we all have challenges. We all face adversity. We all have things that happen to us every day in our lives. We're going through right now something with this COVID thing, but continue. Whatever you do, do not give up. Somebody needs to hear that on the show. Do not give up. Continue to put one foot in front of another, because I can tell you, I came closer to giving up than I ever have in my life. Like I told you, when my children were taken from me. And I'm glad I didn't, because the last 4 or 5 years of my life have been some of the most incredible times of my life. And so, you know, it's don't listen to a voice that says give up. You know, instead continue to go forward towards the dreams that you know that you have, because those dreams have been given to you for a reason, and they've been given to you by someone who has created you. So continue to go towards them.
Those are good words. Good words, Daniel. You know, sir. Sometimes, you know, it's not just a straight line from A to B. You know, sometimes you have to go, you have to veer off, and it's about problem solving. You know, whatever goal you're going for, you're going to have problems. You're going to have things that blockades, obstacles.
Lots of them.
our job is to overcome those obstacles, problem solve, find a way to get around it. Keep your eye on that. I said earlier, keep your eye on the prize. Don't focus on the obstacle. Don't focus on what's stopping you from getting there. Figure out a way to get around it. So absolutely. Awesome stuff.
Absolutely.
I could talk a whole show with you about mindset, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. We can do it again.
We can do it again. Yeah. What's stopping us?
Yeah, nothing. Only ourselves.
one thing that I didn't know until I was just talking to you before the podcast, the listeners can't see. I'm going to put this on YouTube as well, but you're actually wearing a Cleveland Browns hat.
And, I am.
You're wearing a Cleveland. I know you grew up a Redskins fan, but you're wearing a Cleveland Browns hat. And I asked if you were wearing that for the show, and you said you did, but you also went a step further and you have a Believeland tattoo.
Right.
On your arm.
There it is. Absolutely.
Believeland. Yeah, right on his forearm. For those of you on YouTube, just saw that. But for the listeners who didn't see that, you can go on YouTube and check it out. But he's got Believeland right on his arm. So you have a tie to the Cleveland Browns. You have a story that relates to the Cleveland Browns and owner Jimmy Haslam. If you could just for the next couple minutes share that story with me, because I think it's fascinating.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
for sure, Jason. Well, you know, and this goes back to my wife, Samantha, you know, who I met, you know, when I was closer to giving up than I've ever, you know, ever gotten to. And, you know, she kept, you know, she would sit at different restaurants and coffee shops with me, and she would tell me, you know, you need to be back in the NFL. I'm like, well, that's a nice thought, but, you know, it's a lot harder than that, you know. And she's like, well, three things I see you light up about: God, me, and football. And I said, well, you know, I, you know, so she kept encouraging me. She would, you know, and I went through a time I got so mad at God. I mean, I was in full-time ministry when I lost my kids were taken from me. I got so mad at God that I walked away from a lot of what I was doing. I preached at 13 different churches. I was on 3 different radio shows. My book was available in 11 different countries at one point. And I just kind of walked away from all of it. And she kept encouraging me. She said, you know, you really need to be, you know, do some things. She would put up like my whatever it takes, you know, like cards made for the, you know, book and stuff. She put them up in different mirrors around the house and stuff. And, you know, she said, you know, you really need to try to do this. And so I was kind of moving in that direction, if you will. And one night in 2017, I have this dream, Jason. And it's as real as we're sitting here right now looking at each other. And in this dream, I'm the general manager of the Cleveland Browns. And I can see it as clear as day. And I wake up from the dream. And there's a lot of details I want to get into, but I remember talking to the owner and everything in the dream, and I wake up and the Holy Spirit of God says to me, send a card to the owner of the Cleveland Browns and tell him you can put together a Hall of Fame staff within 3 weeks of giving the opportunity, and send him a copy of your book, whatever it takes. So I turned to my wife Samantha, and this is 2017, and I said, I just had an incredible dream. And she goes, what'd you dream about? I said, well, I'm the GM of the Cleveland Browns. She goes, wow. You know, we were both working a sales job in Tempe, Arizona. And so I grabbed one of my books, whatever it takes, and we went to work that day. And after work, we stopped at FedEx Kinko's, and I got the address for Mr. Haslam. And I put together that card and my book, and we Federal Expressed it to the Cleveland Browns, and didn't give it another thought. And we went on our anniversary trip down to Key West, Florida, where we currently live. We end up moving here. We love to hear so much. And we got back from our trip and back to Arizona, and Samantha's going through the mail, and she's like, Oh my gosh. I said, what, honey? And I was like, what, a big bill?
What now?
What? Nothing ever good comes in the mail besides bills and junk mail. Right.
I mean,
excuse me. Well, not for me either. So I said, what do we get? And she holds up this envelope, from the Cleveland Browns. And I was like, oh my gosh. And, so I, you know, we called our kids, you know, she's got, 3 kids that are living with us, my stepchildren. And, you know, we always try to show them different examples, how God moves in our lives and, you know, they have faith and go for the impossible and go for your dreams. So we called them down and we opened up the envelope. And of course it's a letter. Yeah. I can see, you know, it's from, I sent it to you before we went on air, so you could see it too. I mean, it's from Jimmy Haslam. And, you know, just kind of paraphrasing, you know, it says it's, you know, from the desk of Jimmy Haslam, it says, you know, dear Daniel, thank you so much for your copy of your book, whatever it takes, you know, please know we're trying to put together a team, you know, that Cleveland richly deserves. And if you have the time, feel free to send me some of your ideas. I would love to take a look at them. Sincerely, Jimmy. And he signed Jimmy in handwritten pen. And you saw it, Jason. I mean, I sent it to you, and so that was an amazing moment for me, because getting a letter to an NFL owner is like sending a birthday invitation to Bill Gates. It's these guys, you know. Hey, Bill, you're invited to our kid's birthday party, and all of a sudden Bill Gates shows up at your door. I mean, it's almost impossible. These guys are billionaires. They have other people opening their mail. They're very well insulated, you know. So to actually get a response back from Mr. Haslam was incredible. And of course, you know, I took the ball and ran with it, just like I always have in my life. And, you know, that turned into be over the next 7 months, I evaluated the Cleveland Browns and put together a 166-page revolutionary general manager plan for Mr. and Mrs. Haslam, and sent it to the Browns. And then, you know, during that time, it was early December that year. You know, one of my plans was to, in my opening statement to Mr. Haslam in the proposal was, you know, one of two things is true, sir. Number one is either I'm either utterly and clinically insane, or I'm about to build the greatest dynasty in the history of the National Football League. It's up to you to decide as you flip through these pages. And in the proposal, I talked about, because the Browns were coming off that winless season, you know, when they're having the funeral procession around the stadium and all that was so terrible. And I told him, I said, I'm prepared to step up to the podium and pronounce your team Super Bowl 53 champions. And, you know, I had just, the book was chock full of revolutionary ideas, things that the NFL has never seen before, Jason, because to me, greatness is defined as being different. And I had a lot of different revolutionary ideas in there. And even the coach I was going to hire was somebody that nobody probably even knows, you know, and somebody who I think is even a more aggressive coach than Bill Belichick even is. If you're going to beat Bill, you got to get somebody more aggressive. And that's Kevin Kelly, who's a high school football coach right now in Pulaski, Ohio, Arkansas. And Bill knows him very well. If you Google Kevin Kelly's name, Bill Belichick has him up to Foxborough once a year. He knows him very well. And that's the guy who I want to be my head coach. And so I outlaid all this plan. Well, part of my plan was not to have a punter on the roster. And that's something Kevin, you know, Coach Kelly excels in. We're going to go for an every fourth down. I don't care if it's fourth and 38. How are we going to do it? Figure it out. You know, because it was just, we're going to go for an every. And so I was talking to my wife. We were at a Christmas party at the company working in early December. And I turned to her and I said, Samantha, I said, and I was going to make her my co-general manager, making her the first female GM in NFL history. And I said, you know, Samantha, I said, I really think we need to get more aggressive with this. And she goes, what do you think? And I said, I think we need to fly to Cleveland. And so the next day in my email, there was two tickets for my Christmas present from Samantha from Arizona to Cleveland. And she said, Merry Christmas, honey. And we went and bought a new suit for me, orange and brown tie. The whole thing at the men's warehouse. We bought her a real nice outfit, and we did it. We buy faith and faith alone. We spent over $100,000 in the pursuit of the GM's job with the Browns, in time and money. And we flew from Phoenix, landed in Cleveland, rented a car, drove to Berea, the Marriott Berea, and we drove to the complex and we parked. And I was like, my heart was in my throat. And I was like, wow, this is getting really real, really fast. And we said our prayer.
They didn't know you were coming.
They didn't know we were coming, and we came uninvited, and we walked in the front doors of the Cleveland Browns, and you know, we walked up to security guards, you know, desk, a whole plexiglass in the front when you walk in, yeah. You know, like a check cashing place or something, and you could tell he did not get this one in training, and he says, and you are, and I said, Daniel and Samantha Kelly, and you're here to see, I said, Mr. Haslam, please. His eyes got really wide. He's like looking at us. He looked at the list. He looked at us. He looked at him. And you could tell he was getting really nervous. Like he was like at a loss, you know, and he says, I don't see your name on the list, sir. And I said, no, I said, it's not. And he goes, hold on for a minute. And he disappeared for about 5 minutes. Right. And we're standing there in the by the desk.
Unbelievable. This is absolutely unbelievable.
Absolutely. And he says, he comes back, he says, I'm sorry, you're really going to have to have invitation to sit down with Mr. Haslam and talk with him. And I said, I completely understand. I said, can I leave my name and telephone number? We're staying at the Marriott. I said, he knows who I am. I said, you know, we've corresponded through the mail. He goes, well, sure. So I wrote down my name, my telephone number, so we're at the Marriott, you know, handed it to the security guard. We never heard back. We walked out there. We took pictures in front of the Cleveland Browns building. Matter of fact, my next book is we called The Dream, the true story of two fans attempting to become the GMs of the Cleveland Browns and do the impossible ... again. So this whole story I'm sharing with you, Jason, and with our listeners is going to become a book. And it's not just a book about going for my dream. It's a book about it trying to motivate, inspire people to go for their dreams. And sometimes it takes that bold move, that 4th and 42, just go for it. People say, that sounds crazy. You're just going to fly to Cleveland and try to see Jimmy Haslam. And it's like, yeah, absolutely. I've been doing this stuff since I could crawl. I mean, this is the kind of stuff, but this, if you want to have a dramatic, an incredible result, sometimes you have to do incredible things. And so it was an incredible journey. It was an incredible journey of faith. And it was an incredible experience. We fell in love with Bria. It was snowing. It was very romantic. I stood outside. I took a picture by the big Cleveland Browns, the big monument outside the complex. And it was an incredible experience. We went to a sports bar, watched a college football game together. We ended up going to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. It went to the Amish country. My wife loves the Amish people, so we did all that. And it was just incredible. We fell in love with the area. The area really resonated with us. And we said, you know what? This is for us. And of course, it didn't go that way. John Dorsey got the job. But it was still just an incredible journey. It's the first time I'd walked back into an NFL building since I left the Jets.
I want to give kudos to your wife, Samantha. It's so important to have support at home, especially, I mean, I don't work for the NFL. I haven't yet. But I imagine that having a job in the NFL is long hours, long weeks. There's probably not a whole lot of time off. So to have support at home is probably just crucial. And it really sounds like from what you're telling me on this podcast is that Samantha's totally got your back, 100% support. And I just think that's awesome.
Yeah, Jason, you're gonna make me cry. It is awesome. She has believed in me. Really, when I stopped believing myself, it was something where it was such a blow to me to basically for my now ex-wife to say to me that our children are better off without their dad. It was just devastating. So she, on the other hand, took me in and much like, Jesus calling Lazarus out of the tomb, she breathed life back into me and she believed in me and believed in my dream. And she's the one that sat there. I mean, she scouted the scout, she saw the potential that was inside me. And she said, you didn't really need to go towards it. As a matter of fact, this last year, I had a chance to interview with the Washington Redskins with Bruce Allen, who was the president of the team. And it was Samantha because even I get discouraged at times, Jason. I'm human too. I'm not Cam Newton. I don't have a Superman thing underneath my jersey. It was January of 2019. And she said, you should really – this book, she goes, you should really send this out to the Redskins, and that's my childhood team, the team I always wanted to work for. And I said, why? I was kind of down. I was like, why? She goes, just send it to him. And I said, to who? And she goes, send it to Dan Snyder, send it to anybody, send it to someone. And so I sent one copy of the book to Dan Snyder, the owner of the team, and one to Coach Gruden at the time. And in January, didn't hear a thing for 9 months. And all of a sudden, the phone rings. And last September, we're watching a reality TV one morning. And I'm flipping through my Facebook, sitting in my boxers. She's watching reality TV. And also my phone rings. It says 703-726-7000. And I'm like, this looks like Virginia. I get a lot of telemarketing calls. I'm like, I'm going to answer this one. So I answer it. And I said, hello. And the voice in the air on the phone says, is this Daniel? I said, it is. He goes, Bruce Allen, president of the Washington Redskins. How are you doing? I like look at the phone. I'm thinking, is this a prank? I'm like, this is one of my friends, and I put on speakerphone, right, Jason? I put on speakerphone, and sure enough, it's the president of the Redskins at the time, and the call. What's crazy is all throughout writing this book, I had a thought. The 10 years it took me to write this book, I had a thought that one day this would lead to a call from the Redskins, and it did. And Bruce Allen said, listen, somehow, some way, he said, I got a hold of your book. I read it cover to cover last night. I just had to call you. How are you doing? I'm like, great. And he's like, how's your health? And of course, I talked on my book about my battle with testicular cancer, my first month in the job with the Jets. And I went into detail with that about him. And he said, I said, I've been cancer free for 20 years. He goes, that's wonderful to hear. And, you know, and then he talked to me, he goes, I'm so sorry about your daughter. And I got a little emotional and because I was told I'd never be able to have kids probably by one of the a world famous surgeon, Dr. George Boswell at Sloan Kettering Hospital in Manhattan. Went through two major surgeries, one testicle removed. Doctor said I'd probably never be able to have kids. And I had a little girl named Bailey during my time with the Jets, named after Champ Bailey, October 16th, 1999. And after I went through my battle with testicular cancer at 15 months old, she was diagnosed with neuroblastoma cancer, stage 4. They found a tumor the size of a softball above her left kidney. She most aggressive kind of cancer there was for stage 4. And so she had to go through 6 rounds of chemo, 5 surgeries, and a bone marrow transplant before she went home to be the Lord Jesus Christ on Christmas Day in 2001. And you know, so I explained all that in my book, what that process was like, and it was just gripping and heart ripping the right. And so he's like, I'm so sorry about your daughter. I said, well, thank you, Mr. Allen. I said, you know, thank you for saying that. He said, listen, he goes, I really love your story. I love your passion. I love your perseverance. I love everything about it. He says, I really want to have you out here to Washington, and I want to sit down with you, and I want to get your ideas on what you think we should do. I'm like, okay. I'm like, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, I want to have you out here. And I said, yeah, okay. And so it turned out to you know, he invited me out there, sat down with him for an hour and a half, an interview in his hotel suite in the Gaylord National Convention Center. I got a chance to go to the game the next day. I sat down with him. He talked about, you know, possibly putting me in a position under a special teams coach, possibly a position in scouting. And of course, then he got fired on Black Monday. But it was an incredible experience. I had a chance to even walk onto the field with the greats from the 80s. They were honored before the game. And I stood down the tunnel at FedEx Field. They gave me a special pass. It was like a make-a-wish, only I wasn't dying. You know, it was incredible. I mean, I walked down the field. It was raining. I was standing right next to Jay Schrader, Timmy Smith, Ricky Sanders, Gary Clark, Joe Jacoby, all my heroes growing up. And I got a chance to walk on the field with them, the midfield, as they were honored. Charlie Brown asked me to walk up with him, was one of my friends on the team. So it was a dream weekend. It was a surreal experience. But my point being, to your point, Jason, about Samantha is that I would never even sent that book out there if it wasn't for the love and support of my wife. And I would never made it this far. Even my scouting mentor, my mentor in life, Lionel Vitale, says that, you know, Dan, if you didn't meet, you know, Samantha, you'd be under a bridge somewhere. And it's exactly who and what I needed, and God centered in my life.
That's awesome. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about having support. You know, if a man has a woman that can support him at home, and then if you have 2 or 3 really good friends in life that will just tell you the truth and shoot you straight, I mean, man, you're a lucky guy. So you seem like absolutely. You got it going on there. Yeah,
absolutely. No, I completely agree. And like I said, it's she's awesome. She's awesome. There's a reason why she's gonna be my co-GM. She knows talent better than me. We got a big argument. Well, not an argument. I don't want to say argument, but you know, I said, well, you know, if we get this job, I want to keep Josh Gordon. And she's like, no, Josh needs to go. We got on this kind of thing going back together, back and forth. And of course, Josh didn't work out. And she keeps telling me to this day, she's like, see, you would have kept Josh. And I told you we need not to have him. It's like, okay, yeah, you win that one, you know. And she doesn't know a lot about the game per se, but she loves it because I, you know, we love it together. We've got into it together, and she's got into it with me, she says. But it's something where she can pick out the best players on a field, that she just points them right out. She has a natural eye for talent, and she's going to school right now for psychology, and she'd be great in that role.
Well, one thing that I found out tonight, you know, when you hear somebody on a podcast or read about them in the paper, you don't know how old they are. And you're a young guy. Your journey started at a young age. And I'm looking at you now. You're still young, man. You got a lot ahead of you.
Hey, thanks. Thanks. Absolutely. My grandma, who was 97 when she passed, she was born in 1913. She thought everybody was young. She'd call people in their 80s a young person. And I said, Grandma, I said, what's it like being 97? She goes, on her birthday, she goes, oh, that's terrible. She goes, I wish I was 91 or 92 again. So absolutely no. But thank you. Thank you, Jason. I tell you what, I can, you know, my wife and I, we still like to go out. We like to dance. We like to do all those things. I can still close it down like I'm 21, 22 years old. When I'm around the game, my energy level spikes and goes through the roof. So I mean, I've been in stadiums before where I've led entire sections in cheers. I mean, I have an energy level to me that I appreciate recognizing that. But yeah, I love life and I love football and love God and I'm, whatever's next, I'm ready.
Man, when this COVID thing's over, me and you ought to go catch a game together. I think that'd be a blast.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It'll be a lot of fun. So we'll definitely do it.
I'll fly to Florida or wherever you're at. You know, we'll just go watch a game and, you know, have a good time.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. That'd be awesome.
Well, I want to talk about what's next. You know, we've talked about what has already happened, but let's talk about what next. What's the next chapter for Daniel Kelly?
Whatever God has, really, you know, it's life has been so surprising to me in so many different ways. I mean, right now, like I share with you offline, I mean, doors have opened over the last couple of weeks. They've seen me. I was interviewed by Linda Cohn, the legendary, you know, broadcaster from ESPN, mm-hmm. the anchor there. You know, recently I got extended an opportunity to write for Sports Illustrated Detroit Lions. So I don't really know where it's all going. My wife even asked me that over dinner. About a month ago now, she said, you know, where do you think this is all going, Daniel? And I really don't know. But again, you know, I'm trying to be as mindful as I can to those two pieces of advice I give others, you know, pay very close attention to the ideas that just come into my mind. And then, you know, end up, you know, paying close attention to people coming in my path. I mean, it's kind of crazy, right? Because like I write now for the Key West Citizen, the newspaper down here in Key West, and I've never been a journalist before, but I ended up getting this job down here. And it's surprisingly enough, you know, how I didn't just get the job in Washington, right? Surprisingly enough, the family that owned the paper I work for is the Cook family, who used to own the Redskins. They owned the paper up to 2 years ago. And the other day, I had to leave a message for Thomas Cook, who's the grandson of Jack Ken Cook, who's a legendary owner of the Redskins, who passed away, who built the stadium, all this stuff in Washington. And I had to call him about a story I was doing, and he called back and left a message for me. So now I may have an opportunity to meet the grandson of the legendary Redskins owner. So, I mean, who knows where it's all going? I have no idea, to be honest with you. I know it's going somewhere incredible. And I had a vision in 2006 where God gave me this vision. I was standing in the podium and the confetti was coming down and I was holding the Super Bowl, the Vince Lombardi trophy. And I had a chance to share the gospel of Jesus Christ unapologetically, uncensored, in front of every nation standing at the podium. And I know that day is coming where I'm going to have that opportunity to do that. So I just don't know the details, Jason. I don't know the when, where, how, who. I don't know the details, but I know that it's coming. I know that for a fact.
Do you have a goal to get back in the NFL?
Absolutely. I love to be back in the NFL. Love to do this again. Feel like and this is something too, is that when I was in the NFL before, Jason, I was kind of like a wild racehorse in the desert, you know, that triple crown winner, if you will, that had no discipline, no focus, no patience. That's the big one, right? I got in the Jets building and I thought there was two people that ran the Jets. I was wrong. There was only one. His name was Bill Parcells. It wasn't Parcells and Kelly. It was just Parcells. And so I overstepped some things. I shouldn't have overstepped. I overstepped some boundaries. I irritated some of the wrong people. Just out of pure just passion, just out of pure immaturity. You know, and so I feel like the last 18 years has really branded that, you know, through all these experiences I've shared on the show tonight. I feel like a lot of these experiences really, really helped me be a lot more comfortable sitting in the pocket, if you will, in life, and really being a lot more patient and having a lot more maturity, a lot more understanding. Because once upon a time, I was literally sitting in the best chair in the NFL under Scott Pioli. All I had to do is get the stupid chicken wings and do it, you know, make the highlight tapes. I'd probably have 3-4 rings right now, and I'd probably be a GM right now, you know, if I just done what they asked me to do and just gone that rank and just earned my stripes. So I feel like the last 18 years have really kind of branded that maturity in me. So the next time the phone rings and it happens, I'm going to be able to walk through that door and play the hand properly and get to where I'm supposed to go and where this has all been leading all along.
Well, you know, one thing's true. I'm not the same guy I was 18 years ago. You know, than I am today. You're not the same guy you were 18 years ago. We go through challenges, right? Life, tribulations, all that stuff. So, and we grow. You know, we grow. I'm not going to be the same guy 18 years from now. Hopefully, I'm better. So,
right? Yeah, absolutely. I hear that.
as far as getting back in the NFL, are you open to whatever position, whether it be a pro scout again?
Absolutely. I don't care if it's sweeping the floor. I offered in 2009. I actually sent out a letter to every NFL owner, GM, executive, and I kind of put myself out there and said, here's the immature mistakes I made. I learned from them, and I'm willing to come in for a month and work for free in training camp just to prove myself to you. So it's not GM or bust. I mean, that was just because of a dream that I was given at that time with Jimmy Haslam. But I'll do whatever it takes. Whatever it is, whatever door that opens. And my wife said, she said, I'll work two jobs, whatever you need me to do. The help with that, but I'll do it for free because I love it so much. But just a chance to prove, because I know if that door opens, it great things are going to happen. And Bruce Allen even said, when he showed me to the door in his hotel suite, he turned to me and he was kind of talking about, well, I'll call you, we'll talk again down the road after the season. And he turned to me and he almost prophetically said, one thing I know, Dan, he looked at me, he said by the door, he goes, one thing I know, great things will happen for someone that has as much passion as you have. So it's whatever it takes, whatever door opens, whatever happens. I just want the opportunity again because I know it's my destiny.
So powerful. And you don't know what connection, what conversation you're going to have that's going to lead you to that. It could be anybody. I mean, it could be this podcast tonight. We don't know.
It can be you. Because here's the crazy thing, Jason. Lionel Vitale has taught me with the Dallas Cowboys, again, my mentor for the last 20 years. And he was Bill Belichick's most trusted scout when he was in New England. He taught me about 6 degrees of separation, right? You've heard that one?
I have.
Yeah, 6 degrees of separation. We're only 6 people away from anybody in the world. Like for example, like you're talking to me. I know Lionel, and he talks to Jerry Jones every week. So you're like 2 people away from the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. I'm sure you know people, and vice versa. And that's another thing too. When people are walking around, if you're listening to this, you may go to a grocery store, and the cashier at the grocery store that's helping you may know somebody that knows somebody that can actually get to you to your dream spot, or that audition, or that opportunity. So you never know. That's very prophetic you say that, Jason, because somebody could be listening right now. Somebody who's about to who wants to buy an NFL team could be listening to this podcast, or somebody who knows somebody who wants to buy an NFL team or is going to buy an NFL team, and all of a sudden they hear this podcast, they pass it along, or they hear it, and all of a sudden there we are.
Or somebody that currently owns an NFL team.
It could be It could happen just like that.
What's exciting about life is, we're only on this planet one time, so we have to do the best that we can with what we have, and that's what's exciting. You don't know what's around the corner. You never know what God has in store for you. So, Daniel, I'm excited about you, man. I'm excited to continue to follow your journey, and for sure, we're going to continue to stay in touch.
Absolutely. No, I'm looking forward to it. Absolutely. This has been great. Your show is great. The direction you're going with it is great, because I love the life lessons you try to weave into the story through the game of football and the insights you provide to your listeners. You're on your way. Your journey's accelerating. You said it's only been 8 weeks. Your journey's accelerating for a reason, Jason, because you're going to find as you go on, you'll look back at this. You'll say, yep, that makes a lot of sense now, how this all happened, how it played out. So whatever vision dream you've been given, continue to pursue it, because that's the way this stuff works.
Well, thank you so much for those kind words. And again, I'm going to get online right after we hang up, and I'm going to buy that book.
I can't wait to hear what you think about it.
I'm definitely going to let you know for sure. So how can the listeners find you? I know you're on Twitter, but if you could just plug yourself, how can people get a hold of you?
Absolutely, Jason. I'm on Twitter at Daniel Kelly Book. If you go on Google and type in Daniel Kelly NFL, Daniel Kelly NFL New York Jets, you'll see pages of information. I write for Sports Illustrated Detroit Lions. I write for Rego's Rag, which is the third largest publication for the Redskins online. And of course, my hero of all time is John Riggins, so that's kind of cool. I write for Touchdown Europe out of Serbia. I've been on podcasts in 6 different countries in the last 2 months. So So USA Today, I've been quoting USA Today, New York Times. So, I mean, if you type in Daniel Kelly, Tim Tebow, you'll find a story that we haven't talked about tonight, which is a really cool story. In my book website, if you want to learn more about my story, go to whateverittakesbook.com. Again, whateverittakesbook.com. And if you type in, you know, whatever it takes, Daniel Kelly, you know, my book's available anywhere online. Books are sold, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, you name it. And I've never cashed one royalty check yet. And because, again, I didn't write the book. I did not write. And I work a job, so it's not like I'm loaded. I didn't make the NFL make Patrick Mahomes money. But I never cashed a check because, again, I didn't write it for myself or for my own glory or for my own benefit. I wrote it for you. And, you know, I really didn't even want to write my book. I struggled even putting my name on my book, rather. And because it's God's story told through my life. And it's told for you. And you're not listening to this podcast by accident. You know, this, you're meant to listen to this at this point of your life, at this point of your journey. You're meant to hear this right now. And you're having one of those moments where God is winking at you.
Well, let's end it with that. That's good stuff, Daniel. I'd like to thank you for coming on the Browns Huddle podcast, and I look forward to following the rest of your journey. And man, I'm your biggest cheerleader. I'm on your side. I'm pulling for you, brother.
Thank you, Jason. Yeah, it's awesome, man. We have a really good rapport. Yeah, I definitely want to stay in contact with you. Thank you so much. And likewise, I'll be pulling for you. And anytime you want to have me back on to talk Browns football or anything else, I'm only a tweet away.
Well, let's do it again soon.
Sounds good, sir. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.